Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Science Bloggers podcast. I'm David Latchman, and this week's guest is Moxie LaBouche. Moxie is a goat farmer turned burlesque dancer turned podcaster and now author. She is the host of Your Brain on Facts podcast and author of the book Your Brain on Facts, Things You Didn't Know, Things You Thought You Knew, and Things You Never Knew You Never Knew. In this episode, we talk about some of her more sciencey episodes and the problems and some of our frustrations in communicating science in a pandemic world. So, hello, Moxie. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on today.
It's good to have you. Been listening to a lot of the episodes on your podcast and really enjoying and learning a lot from them.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So why don't we start by telling the listeners a little bit something about yourself and what you do?
Well, I am a goat farmer turned burlesque dancer turned podcaster and soon to be author.
Wow. I don't know where to begin.
Yeah, kind of a journey there.
So why don't we just take it from the top and go all the way down and tell us this? Sounds like a fascinating story.
Yeah, well, for a little over a decade, I raised dairy goats and made goat milk, soap, and skincare products that I sold at farmers markets and craft shows and things of that nature. It was during that particular career path that I was struck by lightning. And so if I have like a spacey moment or forget something obvious, that's why. Toward the end of that, I found out that burlesque is still a thing. I thought that had gone out just after World War II, and I got into that, during which I had the privilege of producing the only George R.R. Martin approved Game of Thrones burlesque show. And we got to we got to go to his theater at his invitation and play for the man himself.
That's cool.
Which I need to stop bragging about because it was 4 years ago, but that may go down as my main bullet point in my biography.
Well, you know, I think that's cool. You know, if I, well, I don't think I can do it, but if I was a burlesque dancer that performed for George R.R. Martin, I would boast about it every day. I mean.
Oh, yeah. I used to shoehorn it into a lot of conversations. And, you know, anyone can be a burlesque dancer. My husband performs under the name Dante the Inferno. And in fact, Moxie LaBouche, my podcaster name, is my burlesque name. I just carried it over. And Dante did an act as George R.R. Martin in front of George R.R. Martin, which he said was the most nerve-wracking experience of his life.
Wow. So what did George R.R. Martin say about his performance?
Well, so my husband had the padded belly on, because Mr. Martin is a husky fellow. He had the fisherman's cap, the beard, and there had been on one of the late night talk shows, they went, you know, we cut now to George R.R. Martin working on the last book. And it's a guy dressed as Mr. Martin jumping up and down on a backyard trampoline. So we got one of those living room aerobics trampolines, the little ones. And he did his whole routine while jumping up and down on the trampoline to the Todd Rundgren song. One of them goes, I don't want to work. I just want to play on the drum all day. And Mr. Martin said he was a little nervous when Dante was taking off his boxers, but the gag there was he had a smaller pair of boxers on underneath. And I mean, during the act, he fakes a heart attack and gives himself chest compressions because people are also bother Mr. Martin all the time about, well, what's going to happen if you die before it's finished? Which he now just responds by giving people the finger, understandably. And don't ask him when the book is going to be done. Every time you do, he kills another Stark.
Well, how many of them are there left? Well, yeah, there aren't that many left alive.
Yeah, there's not a lot. We don't have a lot to spare.
Well, the main family doesn't have that many alive. But, you know, they're also these, I guess you call them satellite branches of the Stark family tree or the main family
tree. Yeah, the extended family.
So, yeah, the extended family. So I guess, yeah, there are a lot of people to kill still.
Yeah. We're just hoping in the last book there's going to be a character named Dante, but spelled a little funny, that gets murdered horribly. That's, fingers crossed for that.
I think at this point, you know, it'd be an honor to be killed, even though so many people have been killed. So I don't know. We'll see. So I forgot the list that you said. You said you were a goat farmer,
burlesque dancer, and then into the podcasting brings us close to where we are now.
Right.
Because my head is just full of extraneous facts. I have a fact to stick in everywhere, whether there's room in the conversation for it or not. Like, you know, when I was a cashier at a grocery store, the customer doesn't necessarily want to hear about the prehistoric ground sloth that would redistribute avocado seeds, and that's why their pits are so huge. They just want me to ring up the avocado and let them leave. And my husband started getting into podcasting, and I was very slow to warm to the idea because, like a lot of people, and as a podcaster, you probably understand this problem, they don't know what it is, where you find them, how do you find one you like. They sound like they're going to be boring. I don't want to have to stop everything I'm doing to listen. I had a lot of the misconceptions that are very common in not yet podcast listeners, which I'll refer to the majority of people. But in the car, he played an episode of the Unorthodox podcast, which refers to itself as the universe's leading Jewish podcast. I recommend Jew and Gentile alike check that one out. And I'm like, okay, this is pretty cool. Put on something else. And I, you know, downloaded an app and subscribed to 100 shows. And I thought, you know, I could do this. I could do one of these. And I thought that would be a really good, productive, safe way to vent the useless stuff in my head. Unfortunately, that plan backfired because in having to write a 7-page script each week, it just puts more stuff in my brain.
Well, you know, having a lot of stuff in your brain, it's not a bad thing.
No, but the problem is I have profound memory issues, so the stuff's not where I left it. My brain is basically an encyclopedia with all the pages torn out, scattered around the room, being shredded by squirrels.
Well, yeah, but I don't see that as a bad thing. You know, it's just connecting the dots, so to speak. You know, having everything in one connected space that you can relate everything to each other. So.
Oh, yes. My life is built on tangents.
So I'm sure you do this to your friends as well. It's just like, hey, you're eating a peanut butter sandwich and you'd probably give them some random facts about peanut butter or jelly. But how do they react when you do this?
Most people seem to enjoy it, or they're very good at pretending. I also, you know, I struggle really hard not to drop too many facts into a particular conversation, because it can get kind of annoying. And I totally respect and understand that. So I try to save it up for just the really, really good ones.
Yeah, I sort of know the feeling, because I can sometimes do that as well. So there'd be a conversation and I would just drop a random fact, or I'd correct someone, and then they'll just be like, how the hell do you know that?
I get that question a lot. Like, why do you know these things? Or like, why don't you? It's usually my response. Like, why don't you know it? You know?
I don't say that. I'm going to be just like, I just know stuff.
And when I'll tell people a fact and they'll be like, wow, is that true? I'll be like, it was obscure, it was unprovoked, and it came from me. Yes, it's true. That's the litmus test.
Well, yeah, I guess the people who don't know wouldn't understand. You know, in the defense of podcasts, right, you know, I mean, I also write a blog. I also know, like, other science communicators who have their own YouTube channels. And to anybody out there who is thinking about what medium they want to use to write or to communicate, I would advocate for podcasting for one reason, and that is people are more likely to listen to an entire episode, even if it's an hour long, than read an entire blog post or watch an entire YouTube video. Those two mediums, people tend to, like, especially when it comes to a blog post, they tend to just skim through it rather than actually read it. And not everyone finishes a YouTube video.
Yeah, and you have to be looking at a lot of them. So some, you know, you need both the audio and the video to do it. Obviously, the blog post has to have your complete attention to be effective at all. Whereas with the podcasting, people can be, you know, folding laundry, driving to work, on the treadmill when the gyms reopen, you know, and you're right there in their ear in a much more intimate and personal way than in the other mediums. And I find that our audiences connect to us so much more, because when you listen to someone speak at length, you know, as a regular listener of any particular show, you feel like a kinship. You really kind of feel like you're buds with that person.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, as you said, you can do this while doing another activity. So it's something that's passive. So, but you're still taking in all this information.
Yeah, and you can put it on fast so you can cram it in faster.
Yeah. So that's my plug for podcasting for anyone that wants to do it in the future, especially for the science podcasters, wannabes.
Yeah, there need to be more science-based podcasts because when I look at what's available, like if I go to a conference when I'm talking to other hosts, business, of course, is really big. True crime is huge. And then the rest of it seems to be like woo-woo and lady boss. And there's just not a lot of informative nonfiction podcasting. You know, we could do with a few more science and history shows.
Yes, I totally agree with you. We definitely need more of that, you know, and I think you're right. The business space seems to be saturated, but maybe there's a huge demand for it. I don't know. We'll see. But yeah, we need more science-based or fact-based science podcasts.
We need more fact-based science in the world just in general.
Yeah, it is a reality where right now in this world, it's true facts. We just, you know, don't care about facts if it doesn't align with our...
If the fact is inconvenient, people disregard it. And there's so much misinformation that is so easy to take in. And you can find the misinformation from multiple sources, which feels like corroboration. And then you can claim, well, I did my research. Well, all your sources were crap. The fact that there were three of them, you know, doesn't really make that any better.
That's true. And, you know, it's a problem we all face with as science communicators. You know, it's dealing with those facts and dealing with people who don't like us for telling people about these facts.
Yeah, it's never easy to be the bearer of bad news and to try to pull someone away from an idea that they've latched onto, because the most effective misinformation is the stuff that sounds plausible. Like, oh yeah, no, I could see how that could work, even if you don't fully understand it. It just kind of sounds like it would work. And then you've got them by the nose and you can pull them right down the rabbit hole. We also have an issue with availability and accessibility of credible information, because when you try to read an article on the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal website, there's a paywall. But Breitbart and Fox News, all that's free and easily accessible. So the good stuff is harder to get, but the bad stuff laid out like a buffet.
Yeah. And, you know, you're totally right. You know, I mean, I read the New York Times frequently, and that's because I have a subscription. But I know other science journalist friends, science communicators, who sometimes need to access an article that was published in the New York Times, and they can. And I mean, I'll just like print it out on a PDF and send it to them if I know they're looking for it. But, you know, it's still an access problem.
Yeah, what I usually have to do is there's like a split second after you load the page that you can really quickly copy the text before the site realizes you don't have a subscription. If you're just fast enough, you can copy and paste it out of there. Because unfortunately, the websites seem to also now know when you're looking in incognito mode and don't give it to you then either.
Yeah, I know. Before I used to do that, you know, using in incognito mode or private browsing mode, depending on which browser you use. And now it's become smarter that, which kind of sucks as well. You know, I get it. You know, they need to pay their bills. They need to pay their writers, and good journalism costs money. We need to find a better solution.
Yeah, there's got to be something in the middle between the need for easily accessible, credible information and the very real need to fund good journalism.
I couldn't have said it better myself. You know, we need to find a solution so that it's accessible to everyone, because, you know, when you look at what's happening in the world today, we definitely need it. You know, we need good journalists. We need good access. We need everything. So I was looking at, as I said before, I was looking at a few of your episodes. There, quite a few of them are science-based. Do you want to talk about some of them that you think are the most science-related, fact-related?
Well, one of my favorites, and I mean, I've always loved science. I'm in the Mr. Wizard generation, to date myself there, which for those who aren't familiar with him, he's Bill Nye for old people.
I know, yeah. Mr. Wizard.
You go back and watch it. He really didn't even seem to like those kids, but that's neither here nor there. But yeah, one of my favorite science-oriented episodes is about doctors testing drugs and techniques on themselves, some of which seem pretty sensible, like Jonas Salk actually tested the polio vaccine on himself and his family because there was a really, really necessary rush to get that vaccine developed, improved, and out to people. But then some of them, you're like, really, really, guy? Stubbins Firth, with two Fs, a fellow named Stubbins Firth, wanted to prove that yellow fever was not contagious person to person. And he went to extreme lengths. Anyone who is having their lunch, I apologize. He made a cut on his arm and took vomit from a yellow fever patient and rubbed it in the cut. When he didn't contract yellow fever, he put the vomit in his eye. That didn't get him sick. And then he started eating it and wrote a treatise that yellow fever is not contagious. We do know now that it is contagious. It just requires a vector, in this case, mosquitoes, to pass it from person to person. And that was confirmed by much later research by a U.S. Army surgeon who was breeding mosquitoes for tests on yellow fever, but ironically was bitten by a wild mosquito, got yellow fever, and passed away.
Yeah, I remember listening to that episode and all those things that he went through just to prove that, you know, how yellow fever is transmitted from the truly disgusting things he did. And I was listening to that and thinking, like, man, that is dedication.
Yeah, you got to really be very sure that you were right. I mean, I like being right. I think we all do. I really like being right, but not enough to saute and eat emesis. You know, that's where I draw the line. There's even a more extreme example. Stubbins Firth is in the book version of Your Brain on Facts, which is coming out soon. I wish I actually put the incident that just sprung to mind in there too, which was I've forgotten the name of the condition. There was a niacin deficiency condition that we didn't know at the time was a niacin deficiency, and it seemed like it was a contagious disease, either person to person or from bad water, like you get with cholera. And the scientist who was sure that this was a nutrition-based disease and not an environmental or contagious disease organized what he called a filth party. And he got his very clever wife and his very clever friends together, and they en masse ingested fluids from people with this.
Well, is the disease called pellagra?
Pellagra? Is that it? Yeah. Ingested fluids from the patients, and then none of them got sick to prove, no, this is just a nutritional deficiency because the poor do not have access to good enough food. And that's why we have niacin-enriched flour and bread products.
I remember reading a book on it. I'd gone to this science writing workshop, and one of the presenters, one of the people in the workshop, she had written a book on that condition. And I think it was a book for children, and it chronicled the one deficiency, like what happens to the human body and why we fortify foods to have, you know, certain vitamins and minerals. But yeah, it was pellagra, if I remember correctly.
I love that it's a children's book.
Yeah, it was a children's book. I went to a children's science writing workshop.
Oh, I could have done with that because I tried to do a science podcast and YouTube channel, which was biting off way too much, with my niece. It was called Science with Savannah, age 7, because she's very, very smart and very curious, like I was when I was her age. But it was just, it ended up being too much work and it pod faded, as we say in the industry. That and with my ADD, trying to control her with her ADD and keep her on task, it just wasn't going to work.
Yeah, it can be difficult. But yeah, there are science writing workshops, you know, for writers that want to write for children. I think the one that I went to was run by the Highlights Foundation.
Oh, like Highlights Magazine? Same guys? Cool.
Yeah, like Highlights Magazine. Yeah, they do that. They do a lot of like work for writers to help promote and train writers. And they have like this really nice, I guess you can call it a farm, that they have out there that's nice and remote in Pennsylvania. So it's nice, rustic.
I'm going to look that up.
So if you're into that thing, go for it.
Yeah, I'm going to look that up. I've gone on the road for a lot less than that. I'll tell you that for nothing.
Yeah, and you get to like interact with other writers and talk about writing and science. So if you're into that stuff, it's a place where you probably have fun. I don't know if they're still doing it, but, you know, check it out.
Well, not at the moment, obviously.
So, what other episodes do you think are sciencey that you really enjoy doing?
Oh boy, I'm 109 episodes in, so I'll have a moment where I'll be scrolling through my back catalog and be like, "What? What is that even? I don't even recognize some of the stuff I've covered because I've just covered so much." It's not particularly sciencey, but another one of my favorites, you know, while I'm here desperately scrolling through my list on my phone, is called Well-Traveled Bodies. And it is about, various people who covered more ground after their death than they did, during their life, like the train robber Elmer McCurdy, whose body turned up on the set of The $6 Million Man 80 years after his death. They thought he was a dummy. Ava Perone, who went through three other countries before finally being buried under 20 feet of concrete so that she would be able to rest in peace. And poor Juana Pastrana, who was a Mesoamerican woman from rural Mexico who had hypertrichosis. So she was covered in thick, dark hair, all of her skin. And she had a condition that also made her gums and lips very thick. And so it gave her, and I say this as plainly as possible, a rather simian appearance. And in fact, she ended up on the sideshow circuit and was marketed as the orangutan girl, the monkey girl, the bear girl. One of her promoters married her, probably just to, you know, keep off the competition, had a child with her, but sadly they both died within a few days of the birth. The baby also had hypertrichosis, and then he had them taxidermied. And it actually gets worse from there. But that one was always one of my favorites, and I'm not 100% sure why. In my show, I also try to turn the spotlight more toward people of color and the contributions of women, because the history of every topic tends to be white men all the way down.
Yes.
You know. So I've covered Black inventors, because, you know, so many of the things we use every day are based on the work of people of color. So I did one episode for male inventors and one for female. And I could have done, you know, you could do your whole podcast just on that. Covered any number of animal mating things. I am endlessly fascinated by spotted hyenas. Are you familiar with the mechanics of the spotted hyena?
No, I'm not. What?
Oh, okay. They're amazing. Okay. I feel close to hyenas because, like, they're strangely assembled, and I'm kind of strangely assembled myself. The spotted hyena is one of the species where the females are larger than the males, and the females actually have a clitoris, not exactly like a human clitoris, but a clitoris that is as big and sometimes bigger than the male's penis, making it very difficult for researchers to tell the difference between the males and the females, sometimes even when they have an anesthetized animal. It's hard to tell. They actually, the clitoris of a spotted hyena is also their vagina. It's also their birth canal. So the male has to get, it's an amazing acrobatic feat for the male to get his penis into the female clitoris. But then, couple months later, she has to give birth through it. And a lot of pups actually die in the process because you're trying to like squeeze a puppy through a garden hose. And so there'll be tearing and scar tissue, though the scar tissue actually makes it easier for subsequent births. And it's a It's a female status society.
Matriarchal.
So matriarchal, thank you. I was going for hierarchy for some reason. And males can actually never rise any higher than the status they have unless another male dies. And they can move up one notch, but they will never be above the lowest female in the group. It's not easy being a male spotted hyena.
Yeah, I think I may have either read about this because it's some of these things are coming back to me, or I may have seen it on a YouTube video.
Minute Physics did a good one on it.
Yes, that's probably one I saw.
And Minute Physics,
I think
yeah.
They were saying generally male hyenas are in poor health or they're malnourished because...
Yeah, because they don't get any of the food.
Right, all the food, all the good food, all the actual flesh goes to the females and they end up getting the scraps. So it's mostly the bones and, other stuff that, doesn't have any good nutrition. So they die young.
Yeah, and they're even lower in rank than their own pups because the pups are under the care of the female and therefore they have the female status until the male pups, mature and then they're back down to the bottom.
Yeah, you're just there to propagate the species,
I guess. You have one job, yep.
Yeah. might as well do it as best as you can.
Yeah, and if they could figure out how to do it without the males, they probably would. Various species of snakes and lizards where the females reproduce without males.
Yeah.
I suspect if the hyenas could, they would.
They probably would. Who knows? Probably the next generation or the next species that comes from them will do it. I don't know. We'll see. But, back to some of the things you say, and we're looking at the history of women or minorities in anything, and this especially applies in science. It's not just that it's about white men. It's that we have deliberately erased some of these histories of people who have taken part. So it's not a case of that they aren't people that are not white men who aren't there. They have been there. It's just we've chosen not to tell it. We've chosen to erase it. And, that's also a crime in itself.
Yeah. There is, there were two black men in different situations who were key in teaching anatomy to, white medical students. And, their legacies weren't rediscovered until very recently. And see what I was talking about with the memory issue? I can't remember either one of these men's names, but hopefully this is ringing familiar for somebody and they're yelling at their car stereo right now. And I thank you for it.
Yeah, well, that's the unfortunate fact that, they have so many stories out there that we don't know. And we really have to work towards, figuring it out. And I'm sure you probably discovered that while you've been doing your podcast, as you said.
It's hard to find the information. I want to present the women and the people of color who I know were there. They had to have been there, but their stories aren't perpetuated. So their stories aren't out there to be found. Their stories are copied once for every time, for every 100 times that a white male's story is copied. So I try hard, but sometimes it's hidden even from the researchers.
Yeah, you're right, because I recently wrote a piece on Alice Ball. I guess almost no one knows who she is, but she discovered the first successful treatment for leprosy, and that was around the time of the First World War. And she was a chemist, so she found out this chemical process to get the oil from the tremolo plant, the seed, to get it to dissolve to become water soluble so it can be a deliverable drug. And unfortunately, she died, before she published, because of chlorine poisoning. It was World War I, places were getting bombed and attacked.
Oh, she got gassed?
Yeah, tear gas. So she was demonstrating to a class how to use a mask, and apparently she got exposed to chlorine gas and it affected her. So less than a year later, she died from it. And the dean of the college where she worked, his name was also Dean, I can't remember his first name. He stole her research, published it, and took credit for it. And
yeah, just like Rosalind Franklin, that Watson and Crick got a Nobel Prize.
Yeah, exactly.
For the notebook, you know, the work that they stole from her.
Right, the photograph.
She had passed away before they got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, of DNA, yeah. And she had passed away before they got the award, and Nobel Prizes are not awarded posthumously. So it couldn't even be corrected.
Well, I don't so much have an issue that she wasn't awarded the Nobel Prize because she had died. It's that credit was taken from her.
Oh, no, it was stolen, yeah, but I'm saying it couldn't then be fixed.
Yeah.
And because she had already died.
They didn't even acknowledge that the photograph that they saw and that they were able to base their research on was stolen by her assistant, who showed them that photograph that he had no right to show them, you know, without a permission.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it's a common story.
Understandable frustration. Yeah. Bonus fact for you. Gas attacks are the reason that soldiers stopped wearing mustaches. If you think of soldiers, you know, pre-World War I, they had big, big bushy mustaches, which is why, bonus, the Amish wear a beard but not a mustache, because they're pacifists. And soldiers, when their society formed, wore mustaches. But you need to get a good seal with a gas mask if you want to get out alive. So facial hair had to go. And the chlorine gas attacks were also the basis of the old grandma saying, you know, if you've got, you're making an ugly face, and she says if the wind changes, it'll stick like that. Because if the wind shifted and blew the chlorine gas down into the trench, because it is heavier than the air, yeah, your face is going to stay in a twisted, contorted state because you're dead.
Oh, makes sense.
It's a three bonus facts right there.
Yeah, we're really giving listeners something for, well, their money. I don't know. Any other favorite episodes that you have you want to talk about?
Yeah, let me see again. I've done 109, covered some science fiction, mud. I did a whole episode on mud. I like to challenge myself by doing topics that sound like they should be so small and so boring. And when you look at anything, if you look long enough, fascinating stuff starts to bubble to the surface. It's like I did an episode on salt. I'm a little more history oriented than science oriented.
Yeah, because I know you did an episode on nurses, was it a couple of weeks ago?
Oh, the history of nursing.
And, you know, I really like that you covered Mary Seybold, because I'm from the Caribbean. I'm from Trinidad. And yeah, she's from Barbados, I believe. But it's like really cool that...
I think she might have been Jamaican.
Okay, yeah, that's right. I'm getting it wrong. But yeah, it's really cool that, you know, you focus from someone in the Caribbean, and... That kind of like meant something to me when I was listening to it. So,
well, I'm very glad. And Mother C. Cole is another person whose story is not widely enough known. You know, a lot of women and women of color who made these advances in medicine through nursing, we just never hear about. You know, you hear about the Albert Schweitzers, and you've probably heard the name Florence Nightingale, but you don't really know what she did. Something with a lamp. I don't know. But then there are all of these women who, you know, probably millions of people are alive because of the advances they added to medicine. And we can't be bothered. And why are half of them named Mary? Is the other thing I noticed when I was researching this episode. It's like half of the women who are important in the history of nursing are named Mary, which is my Christian name. And I'm like, did I miss my calling? Was I supposed to be a nurse?
Hopefully you didn't miss it. But yeah, it's something like I never really thought about, that they all name Mary, or most of them are. I don't know. Must be a name follows the profession kind of deal. I don't know. Who knows?
nominative determinism.
So I guess we'll have to figure it out. But yeah, you know.
Yeah. Well, it used to be a more common name. You don't see a lot of people falling over themselves to name their babies Mary these days.
That's true. And I guess colonialism also had a part to it, since it brought Christianity to much of the world. So who knows? Probably there's a smart person who's figured it out and can tell us.
It's probably a combination of all those things. Most things in life are a combination of the many possible sources.
So, yeah, I really enjoyed that nurse's episode. And yeah, Mary Seabold was part of it. So, thanks.
Oh, very, very glad.
So when you were growing up, were you always like this trivia science kind of kid who was interested in those kinds of stuff?
Yeah, I always loved learning. Probably a turning point in that was I was a TV addict of the first order. Just watch TV constantly. So that was the real punishment my parents could put on me, was to take away the TV. Because we lived in a rural part of Pennsylvania, and I was a kid. I wasn't going to go very far anyway. There's no point in grounding me. But take away the TV, and now you have my attention. But I was allowed to watch the news and educational programming. And so, yeah, flip it over to, well, at the time, PBS was the source for educational programming. And I think that fired a dormant desire to learn new things. And I did say science was probably my favorite subject in school. I had a really great science teacher in elementary school who made it, you know, kept it interesting, because science is interesting, but a bad teacher can ruin any subject.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And
admittedly, I didn't do well in physics, though. But thankfully, we had a long-term substitute who wasn't good at physics either, so she kind of took it easy on us.
That kind of sucks, because my background is actually in physics. So
too much math. I'm not good with math. I'm good with words, not so much the numbers.
Well, okay, so here's one secret, and the thing is, almost no one is like as good at math as you think that they are. There's just a lot of hard work for it. And yeah, there are a few individuals who are just naturally talented at it, but even they have to work at it. So I think that's something that all teachers should tell the students, is like almost no one is like really good at math.
Well, it's a strange way our society looks at it. If you're bad at art or music, that's okay. But if you're bad at math, oh, you're just stupid. You know, why isn't it okay not to be good at math the way it's okay not to be good at art or music?
That's true. And to be honest, I know a few physicists who aren't that good at math anyway. They have to really work at it.
And hey, that's what we have calculators for anyway.
Yeah, that's the other thing too.
You know, that's what we have.
We have calculators. Yeah. We have programs that can, you know, analyze this data or solve these equations for us. We still have to put it all together. And that's where the creativity and understanding comes in, you know, of being a scientist. But, you know, they have tools for that. that's all I can say.
See, an interesting thing, I'm one of six daughters, and half of us are blonde like mom and half are brunettes like dad. And the brunettes like dad have math skills, and the blondes do not.
Wow. Well, I don't think it's like a genetic thing there. I think it's probably like a cultural thing where we think, oh, you're blonde, you're not that smart. That's my interpretation.
I'm not sure it was that pervasive on a scholastic level, but come to think of it, my dad did teach me every blonde joke there was to be had, but and short jokes, and when I wanted to be a lawyer, all the lawyer jokes. And I realized as an adult, he wasn't making fun of me, he was arming me, because it can't be used against you if you get there first.
Right.
Like, nobody can use these jokes to hurt you if you tell the joke first.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, it's, you know, you it prepares you for what's out there, you know, and people can be cruel.
But I found that if you can make them laugh, everything in life's a little bit easier.
That's true. Yeah, I totally agree. So is there any particular reason you didn't pursue science when you were a kid?
I had a one year my family moved and I was very, very upset about the move. And I, at that point, didn't care about anything. I stopped playing my saxophone. I stopped applying myself at school and whatnot, and just was like super lazy all through middle school. And I think I just wasn't open to the possibilities. Because it could have been something that I might have pursued, but I just didn't have my eyes open to see the possible science careers. And God knows we need more women in STEM. And yeah, I maybe could have been one of those. But yeah, I didn't leave myself open to the possibilities. But I didn't mind being a goat farmer, and I got to do, you know, a fair amount of biology in that. I had to do a lot of chemistry in making the soap and the skincare products, because it was proper old-fashioned lye soap. So you got to get your pH right there. You know, not as much science in burlesque necessarily, except the adhesive qualities of various glue, depending on which type of fabric you're sticking your rhinestones onto. And I still leave a trail behind me everywhere I go.
Well, you know, back to what you just said about not knowing the possibilities, because I have interviewed a few women on podcasts. And, you know, they all became scientists in some way or the other. But, you know, that was one problem a few of them talked about, is that they didn't know that they could do that. But something happened in their life that showed them that possibility that, hey, I should do this. I'm cool at this. I'm good at this. I want to do this. And I think that's something that, at least in STEM, that we really need to work on, is not just for women, but for minorities, for people of color, for, you know, underrepresented groups. You know, show them that, hey, we need people like you in the field, because diversity is so important, especially when it comes to problem solving. You know, we need those different perspectives.
Yeah, we need people who think differently, because if everybody on the team thinks the same way, you're not going to come up with the answer to your problems. You need the different points of view and the different ways of thinking.
Exactly. So like a little bit of history, at one point in time, the US was the leader in particle physics, right? Almost all research was being done there. And then as they stopped funding for the superconducting
the semiconductors,
it was like the super chilled. Yeah, it was supposed to be like a really large superconductor. It was supposed to be larger than the LHC is right now, but Congress stopped funding for it. You know, they were like halfway done building it, and then Congress decided, hey, this is costing too much money, so we're gonna stop funding. And then other countries started stepping up. And because of that, it means other countries are helping fund these massive projects. So you see countries like France and India taking part. And you would think, okay, this is physics and engineering, right? We have a problem. Everyone is going to come up with the same solution. And it turns out that wasn't the case. Some of the most novel solutions came from these typically underrepresented countries like India, when it came to solving some of these problems that they needed to make everything work. So again, this is a case for diversity in all these fields, you know, not just STEM. And we need to work towards that.
Yeah, it's become painfully obvious that the people in charge here do not have a basic understanding of most sciences. You know, it's like Neil deGrasse Tyson said, why are they always lawyers and business people? You know, why is there no one with a science background? My answer being, please let them keep doing science. We need them doing science. But it would be nice if, you know, just the people trying to write laws regulating women's bodies had like a sixth grade sex ed education.
Oh, yeah.
To, you know, to understand how they work.
Yeah.
Just replant the ectopic pregnancy. Doesn't work like that, Skippy.
Yeah, we need that. It's, you know, just at least a basic understanding of biology would help at this point. But
I think they should have to draw and label the female reproductive system before they can introduce any bills regarding it. And if you can't at least get 70% of that correct, no bill for you.
It would make sense. I don't know if we can do that. Or if,
no, it's never going to happen, but it's nice to dream.
Yeah, it's nice to dream. But, you know, it's not just, you know, the female anatomy and women's rights. It's climate change and...
It's all of it, yeah.
Yeah, it's everything. And with everything with the pandemic right now, you know, it's really frustrating to see some of these things play out on the news.
Yeah, just that the governor of Georgia didn't know that asymptomatic carriers are a thing. And I mean, I can understand that. It's only been 113 years since Mary Mallon was discovered to be spreading typhoid, but it's cool if he's not up to date on that. That's fine.
Yeah, it's astounding at how ignorant we are in science, considering that so much of the world that we live in right now is science and technology based.
Everything is science.
Yeah.
Every single thing is science. And each subsequent graduating class seems to know 5% less than the class before them. And that's how we end up with people who, you know, think wearing a surgical mask is going to asphyxiate you. If that were the case, surgeons would be dropping onto their patients every time they were in the OR.
That,
you know, if we had a better... If we were putting money into science education, we wouldn't have people so dangerously misinformed and easily misled on health and science issues.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, as a science communicator, I acknowledge that there are difficulties in communicating science. You know, when you're communicating these ideas, you aren't just dealing with the facts, you're dealing with challenges to people's belief systems. And, you know, that's a whole different can of worms that I don't know how to deal with, but it's something that we still need to do better because
absolutely
so much is at stake right now.
You don't have to tell me. I have an idiopathic pulmonary condition and I've been sequestered in my house, only leaving once a week so I don't go stir crazy, you know, run to the grocery store. I've been sequestered 3 months next week.
Wow.
So yeah, and my mother's husband has COPD and a number of other problems, and even though she only lives 3 miles away, I don't even let her open the door if I run an errand for her. I'm like, I'm gonna leave it on the porch. You wait till I walk over there, and then you can open it, the door, and get it.
Yeah, I
because I'm just not.
I can imagine.
It.
Yeah, it's probably very, you know, difficult to live, to be alive during a pandemic when you have a major health problem that you're living with. You know, it's
yeah. So I mean, I can't speak for everyone, but I can say that. At least in my family, we are taking this seriously and we are giving side eye to the people in the store who aren't.
Yeah, well, I guess that's all you can do right now, because I think a lot of people don't realize how serious it is. And if they do, they're more concerned, well, it really doesn't affect me, so I don't care about
exactly
you.
Yeah, and they're like, well, I'm healthy, you know, well, yeah, now. But this, you know, we still don't even understand how COVID-19 is killing people. You know, we're trying to play catch up on this because it's not just taking out the old people with pre-existing conditions. It's affecting children, but it affects children very differently than it does older people and people in like their 20s and 30s. It's a whole new set of symptoms in them too. And it's killing them with cytokine storms and strokes. You know, nobody can walk around thinking that they are strong enough to beat this.
Yeah, and you know, I've told friends that, you know, you often hear the president say, oh, in the summer it's going to be warmer, it's going to dry out.
I try never to hear anything he says. I literally cannot stand the sound of his voice.
Well, there's that too, but you know, I keep telling people this is a pandemic virus, and what it means is going to act very differently from a seasonal virus, right? Like the flu, where we can predict. Maybe one day SARS-CoV-2 is going to act like a seasonal virus, but we're not there yet. And we are not going to be there for several years, at least, probably a decade at most. But in the, right now we're in this for the long haul. This is our new world, our new reality, and we have to work around that.
Yeah, I don't think people are aware now that more people know about the 1918 flu than, you know, than knew about it a year ago. But I don't think they know how long it lasted. It was problematic for more than a year. There were multiple peaks, and the first one was not the most serious one.
Right.
In many metropolitan areas, the second spike, like Philadelphia, threw a parade to raise money for the war effort, and that caused massive outbreaks, which we are going to be seeing soon because the businesses that are starting to reopen are not enforcing social distancing.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, that's exactly why that second peak came about. It was because they relaxed social distancing. They said, oh, look, it's going down. We're safe now. Let's go out and do the normal stuff. And that's when that second wave hit and hit hard.
Yeah, but it's the same mentality as saying, I am no longer hurtling toward the earth at dangerous speeds. I'm going to go ahead and take off this stupid parachute.
Yeah.
You know, you're not safe yet. We're not through it yet. Even when it slows down, it's still not safe. And I live in the state of Virginia, and our governor is a doctor. He is unfortunately caving to pressures, but he has been more sensible than a lot of state governors as to our response to the pandemic.
Well, you know, it's difficult to allocate, you know, how much blame should go to the local government, to the state governors, and to the federal government. You know, one of the biggest problems is that the federal government hasn't really shown any leadership at all on this issue, which makes it all that more difficult for the state governors to do anything, right? So even if they do try to do the right thing and say, okay, we need to isolate and stay at home, the federal government is saying, it's like, yeah, we'll leave that up to the states to decide. You know, we're not going to unify the country on this. So essentially now you have an ungovernable populace that doesn't want to do anything. So
yeah, and then you have, you know, area A that's locked down, but then area B that is being reckless about it. And I've seen people say, well, we're not in a hotspot. This thing moves, y'all. All it takes is somebody to get in their car and come to your city. Congratulations, you are the next hotspot. You know, the virus doesn't move. We move the virus. If we all just stop moving, everybody just, your house is not that bad. Your kids are annoying, I'm sure, but they're really not that bad. Your situation is not that bad. We will fix everything when this is over. Yeah, the economy sucks. I've been out of work for 3 months. We can't fix it if we're dead.
Well, yeah, there's that, you know. And I think that's one of the things that I think most people, especially those people that want to end stay-at-home orders, I don't think they realize, yeah, we are all hurting. And those people who are hurting are also the ones that are advocating that we isolate and stay at home. So if we don't see that, you know what, I just don't see how we're going to get through this without massive losses of life.
Yeah, I think it was the MP for Scotland, someone... governmental body in Scotland, she said that if your life has not dramatically changed, you are not contributing to the solution, and you will be responsible for the loss of life. I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember the exact quote, but if your life has not substantially changed since this started, you are not part of the solution, and you will cost someone their life.
Well, you know, if it doesn't substantially change, you know, I'll also say you're extremely privileged for that to happen as well, you know, and
yeah,
you know, if you're in that situation, then, you know, good for you, but not all of us are, you know, so I don't know. I don't know how to comment on that other than
it's a complete mess. In summation, it's a complete mess.
Yeah, I think that's how the best way to just surmise it is just a complete mess. So I think we've talked like about a dozen things so far. Is there anything else you want to talk about before we start wrapping up and you can talk about your book?
Oh, no, we've had a nice meandering conversation through various areas of science and society.
Yeah, we have. And it got political, but science is these days, so...
Yeah, the science has been politicized, and I see people online defaming Dr. Anthony Fauci, and I will defend him with my last breath, you know, like Lord of the Rings, Eowyn defending Frodo, except short and whinier. Because back in the 80s, when the Reagan administration wouldn't admit that HIV existed, back when it was still referred to as GRID, you know, it was gay right in the name of it.
Yeah, gay-related, yeah.
Yeah. And Anthony Fauci pushed that it just be treated like a disease, that it's just a disease and we need to treat it as such and not as a moral punishment. And so he is a number one superstar in my book.
Yeah, and I think that is, not just with the HIV epidemic, but also all the other potential epidemics like SARS-CoV, the first one with Ebola, we're also seeing the inequality in treatment and access. And we're hopefully trying to remedy some of these things, you know, now that we can no longer contain this virus. Because with all these diseases, they impacted poor people more than, you know, wealthy people who were able to somewhat isolate themselves from the effects of this. So I guess we'll see.
Yeah, the situation has sort of magnified all of the underlying societal disparities and failings in our healthcare system, and was not a good and sturdy structure for this thing to land on.
No, it was not. Definitely not. And hopefully, you know, if we do get a vaccine, you know, within the next decade or so, if we are lucky and we do get it within the next 2 years, that we manage to get it to people who may not necessarily be able to afford it, you know, financially, but we can still deliver it to them so they get the help that they need, and we can get this virus under control. I don't know.
we'll just have to hope for the best.
Yeah, I think that's all we can do right now. So, why don't you tell us a little bit about your upcoming book?
Well, it is called Your Brain on Facts: Things You Didn't Know, Things You Thought You Knew, and Things You Never Knew You Never Knew. A bit wordy a title, but hey, it's my first time out, so. It is a lot like the podcast, except that about 2/3 of the contents are topics that have not and will not be on the podcast, so they are exclusive to the book. But just like the podcast, it has science and history and personal stories, not mine, but, you know, biographical type of information. The spotted hyenas are in there. I have to make sure that they got in. There's technology. Everything from like pizza toppings around the world to the unsung heroes of medicine.
So where can we get this book?
You can go to yourbrainonfacts.com/book and it'll 301 you over to the Amazon page, or by all means, contact your favorite local bookstore. You may not be able to go there in person, but they need your love now more than ever.
Yeah, they do. I'm pretty sure. And any small business, you know, they need as much help as they can get. So check Moxie's book out, you know, when it comes out. And on social media, how can people follow you or contact you?
On Facebook and Instagram, it is Your Brain on Facts. And over on Twitter, it is Brain on Facts Pod. You can always drop me an email at moxie@yourbrainonfacts.com.
Okay, and I'll be sure to include all of that in the show notes. And I think we can start wrapping up. It was really nice having you on.
This was a very stimulating conversation. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Same here. And hopefully we can do it again sometime in the future.
Well, right now I've got nothing but time, so.
Same here. Anyway, bye.
All right, bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed my talk at Moxie. If you enjoy learning about things you should know but never learned, you should check out her podcast and book. She doesn't just talk about science, but a diverse range of topics from fiction to history. All links can be found in the show notes. And please, like, share, subscribe, or even leave a comment to this episode. Any support you give goes a long way to helping support this podcast and helping it grow. And I look forward to having you next week when I talk to a new science communicator.